very rarely do long-term good things come from rushing or feeling rushed, as far as I can tell. And conversely, when you take a little bit of time and you're willing to kind of waste some days and weeks, you can, over the span of years, make a lot more progress. If you're never willing to slow down, you end up doing a lot of trivial things really quickly and really well. But there's a risk in getting good at the trivial stuff, because then you're going to double down and do more of the same, let's call it trivial or less important stuff.
Tim Ferriss is the author of best-selling books like The 4-Hour Workweek and Tools of Titans. He's an expert on business and productivity, sharing his thoughts on the world's most popular business podcast, The Tim Ferriss Show.
It's very hard to track your own thoughts, but if you trap your thoughts on paper, you can really cross-examine them afterwards, and you can see where things don't quite make sense or where they're not as compelling as they seem when you repeat them to yourselves a lot. I would say that historically, just having seen thousands of people attempt mini retirements, like tens of thousands, I mean, millions of people have bought this book, right? So a lot of people have tried mini retirements. The most common feedback I get is...
I'm Erica Kohlberg, and you're listening to the Erica Taught Me podcast. Have any of you read that book, Atomic Habits? I read it years ago and loved it. So the author, James Clear, was always on my dream list of people to interview on this podcast. When the opportunity to interview him finally came a few months ago, it had to be recorded remotely. And if you're a regular follower, you know that I don't often do remote interviews. I immediately started researching, trying to find the best possible tool available, and the one name that came up consistently was Riverside. If you don't already know, Riverside is a platform specifically designed for high-quality remote video and audio recording, and it's good for anyone who needs reliable recordings of remote conversations. What I loved about using it is that it puts users first. For example, it records audio and video locally on each person's device, which means better quality, even with varying internet connection. One less thing to worry about when it comes to editing. Speaking of which, their editing tools make post-production a breeze, with features like animated captions and text overlays. When you're editing, you get instant feedback on exactly how your changes impact the overall look and feel of the project. You can also upload content into Riverside and leverage their super easy editing features, such as their text-based editor and automatic clip generation. By the way, if you want to watch or listen to the James Clear episode, you definitely should, to see how it turned out when I used Riverside. It's episode number 65. Right now, you can try Riverside for free, and when you purchase a plan, you can get 15% off with code Erica. Just go to erica.com/riverside. Remember, Erica is always with a K. That's erica.com/riverside. I'll put the link in the show notes so you can try it for free. The 4-Hour Workweek came out in 2007. I have to say thank you because I was in college when that came out. But when I was at the law firm, I really thought that my entire life career was going to be as a lawyer, moving up the ranks to become a partner at the law firm eventually. Mm-hmm. But this was the first book that I read that really opened my eyes to a possibility of something outside of the 9-to-5. So First of all, thank you to you.
Yeah,
my question is, you published it when you were 29. Mm-hmm. What did you, as a 29-year-old, have absolutely wrong about life?
Well, I didn't predict my hair loss would come shortly thereafter. What did I have wrong about life? I don't think there's anything that I would say I got totally wrong in some type of objective sense. I would say that when I go back and occasionally read bits and pieces, the tone of it is the tone at times of a 29-year-old who feels like he has a lot to prove. Right. So there is some of that that makes me like, oh, furrow the brow. But I don't think fundamentally the principles are wrong in any way that I can point to, in the sense that it's me collecting best practices from centuries or millennia of different types of maxims, like the 80-20 principle, Pareto's law, et cetera. So those are things that existed before me, and there are things that will exist after me. And I don't think I got any of that wrong. I would say that certainly and I expected this to be the case, but the tools, the technologies evolved so quickly that even when I did the revised and expanded edition, which is what you have in 2009, so let's just call it 2 years later, almost everything had changed. And certainly now, everything has changed 70 times over. But I'd say the base themes and principles are still as valid as they were in 2007. So that, I would say, is the only reason I can come up with as to why the book is still, I think it is still my best-selling book, even though I have five that have all done really well. It's that the core of it, the, let's just by analogy say, the how to draw, the principles of how to draw remain the same, whether or not you're using an iPad, a piece of charcoal, a pencil. Those are just the tactics, but the strategies are still pretty perennial.
I guess besides being rejected by all of those publishers, why did you feel like you had a lot to prove? Was it something from childhood or just early 20s?
Yeah, I would say that I would probably reframe the, and I know I use these words, but having a lot to prove with being very, very competitive. So that, I think, is probably somewhat box. I think there is probably some nurture, but a lot of it's nature. I'm just highly, highly, highly competitive, right? And it doesn't always serve me. Right. If your mode is like second place is first loser, which is good as a driver, but I think for well-being, oftentimes not the right framing, perhaps. And anyone who competes a lot, I think, would probably agree with that. It doesn't always translate to many places, but I like competing. So as soon as I began pitching this as a book, which was never in the plan to begin with, started as notes from a class, which is also what gave me the confidence in the material, because I had already taught a lecture twice a year. I was invited back to my college by a former professor. I knew the material worked because I'd refined it over many years at that point. And I knew that the messaging worked. Even if publishers said no, I was like, no, you're wrong. Like, I've already field tested this. But once the book was being written, and then certainly with the marketing and everything else, I wanted to show that I could win in that game. And it's a very hard game to win, in part because, let's say, the New York Times bestseller list is actually more of an editor's choice list than a true tabulated bestseller list, which is something you don't really learn typically until that punches you in the face somehow, which is what happened with my third book. So there's a lot outside of your control. But I would say that I felt as a 29-year-old that I hadn't reached escape velocity in a way that I felt I was capable of. So the book was kind of my shot on goal for that.
Yeah.
Even though books are hard. Books are economically tough model to make work. To put together a book, period, it's at least for me very, very, very challenging. And I would like to say it gets easier. I think you can make books that are easier than other books, but to actually sit down and write prose, I think is pretty challenging for most people, especially writers, possibly. So I think I'm very competitive, and that a lot of my well-being and happiness in the last, let's just call it 10 years, has been developing great selectivity in terms of where I choose to compete and where I choose not to compete.
In all of the different ways that you've used to make money throughout your career, from supplements to books to speaking engagements, what has been the easiest?
The easiest is actually the one that I decided to take a long break from doing, which is speaking engagements, probably. Because if you want to make a lot of money with speaking engagements, if you have one or multiple books that are bestsellers, your rack rate goes up. And you start getting these inbound requests for speaking, and they pay very, very well. I mean, if you look at, I'm not going to name names, but some really well-known authors, yeah. I mean, they might make $100,000 a talk, $200,000 a talk. If they have any type of like past high political office, then you can add another 50, 100K on top of that. You know, if it's like a George Clooney or somebody, the numbers get really big. And I stopped doing almost all speaking for around 10 years, even though it was easy because there were a few issues. The first issue is that you're trading time for money, which is antithetical to the book. So it's kind of funny that I would end up being asked to speak to audiences about the tenets in the book while violating the tenets of the book, right? I'm trading time for money in this particular case. The second, which was more problematic, or certainly equally problematic, is that, as a friend of mine pointed out, because he had stopped doing speaking engagements, he said, to really do this well as a business, you need to have maybe two or three set talks that you give over and over and over and over again. Otherwise, it's too much work to personalize. And you end up becoming really calcified in your thinking. You're a single record that you just keep putting on repeat. And that seemed, in the long term, more dangerous than trading time for money, which is why I took a long break. And then I stepped back into it, but I had really strict rules around it. So rather than ending up in this murky middle ground, this is true for a lot of businesses, by the way, but rather than ending up in this murky middle ground where you are, or your agent or someone else is negotiating with different organizers and agents and so on and so forth for the rate and the format and so on, I basically made it a barbell approach, which I do with a lot of things. Nassim Taleb, we have one of his books up there actually, talks about this a lot, but in the context of investing. In my case, I applied there too. But here, what that meant was I'm either going to do speaking gigs for free, where it's either deeply meaningful for whatever reason to speak to this audience, or it's such an impressive audience that I would pay to speak in front of them if I had to, so free, or the highest price that I've ever been paid. And if someone paid me more than the preceding winner, let's just say, in terms of highest price, that became my new minimum. And it just kept on going up. And what that allowed me to do was basically make the same amount of money, say, per year or close to it, with much lower headache, because people would not pay that type of price unless they knew I was the right fit for their audience and they really thought through it. In other words, they weren't looking for a speaker and considering 10 different speakers and then shopping on price. And those engagements have ended up being really fun to do because they've thought through a lot of details beforehand. So I'd say that's the easiest. In terms of the most elegant and rewarding, I would say the podcast, for sure. Because I'm not repeating myself, or I try not to repeat myself. I mean, I'm sure I repeat myself if I'm doing 700 interviews. Imagine I have my lines that I use and book recommendations that get repeated occasionally because there's no way to avoid it. But that is me going to school, basically.
Yeah.
And getting to choose my teachers. So that's just like an absolute dream come true on so many levels. It's a crowded marketplace now. The arena, I think, is going to have some competitive dynamic changes. I think a lot of the models are going to break in the next few years, or at least get compressed pretty significantly. Probably be some race to the bottom type CPM issues and so on. But I don't really care about that stuff since I've had a 10-year run. It's a pretty good run.
So do you think at all about building like a defensive moat around your podcast?
I think about building a defensive moat around my identity so that I don't feel I need to compete, which is different, right? So I could try to build a moat around my podcast as a business. And I feel like I could do that, but to differentiate the branding, which is really just like a consistent association. Like when people hear the Tim Ferriss Show, what do they think? How would they explain it to a friend? That's your brand. Mm-hmm. I could do that. And I think I've done a decent job of that. But the fact of the matter is that what was formerly, when I started, let's just say a blue ocean, has become a very red ocean. And the barriers to entry are very low. There are upsides to that. There are a lot of people doing really good jobs. And a lot of people on YouTube who have incredible cinematic quality to their, really what are television shows, as opposed to podcasts at this point. And the growth engine of YouTube is incredibly useful for people who know how to use it, of course. And I would say, though, coming back to what I said first, for me at this point in my life, the currency that I most traffic in is not income. Even though income is important, it provides fuel. Mm-hmm. So you can accelerate other things, or you can enlarge other things. You can scale other things with income, but it's just one currency. It is also not time, which I talk about in the 4-hour work week a lot as this non-renewable resource, which is still the case. But for me, it's more energy. So if I, in the process of trying to create a defensive mode around my podcast, do anything that drains me, that's a mistake, given my priorities right now. On the other hand, if I do things, for instance, like I've been experimenting with walk and talks, where I throw on a high, really high quality headset and I record a podcast while I'm walking, there's no video. I'm deliberately doing something that on one hand recharges me, mm-hmm. and that energy can be transferred to other projects. Because the podcast isn't the only thing I do. I do a lot of other things. It also is constraining my growth. There's no video. I don't have those assets to use. I can't slice and dice them and put them on TikTok and
do
all.
You could have someone walking backwards following you.
I could, but
I'm sure I
that'd be super super pleasant. I could do that. There are ways I could do video, but there's a quote I used to start most of my speaking engagements with, and I'm probably going to get it off a little bit. So there's a quote from Mark Twain. Who knows? Maybe it was. Could be anyone. Mark Twain and Abraham Lincoln get like half the quotes on the internet, so you never know. But it was, whenever you find yourself on the side of the majority, it's time to pause and reflect. Right now, the majority is doing video, 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 video. And there are a lot of good reasons for that. I would say we don't have to get into all of it. I'm sure you are probably even better versed in all of this, but video is a priority for the platforms. TikTok scared the shit out of everybody. Yada, yada, yada.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of chasing the algo and trying to do what gets rewarded and surfaced. So my general approach, I would say, is, and this sounds cliched, and it is, and it's harder in practice than in theory, but if there's a lot of zigging going on, I try to zag. Not because it's automatically what's going to reward you the most, but because I learn a lot more doing that. And the learning compounds. So when the learning snowballs and compounds, ultimately, I do get rewarded more.
Mm-hmm.
Even if in the short term, I make a bunch of compromises, which is exactly what's happening now with the decisions that I've made format-wise with the podcast. I've made a lot of very deliberate, very well thought through decisions. Not saying they're the right decisions, but it depends on what your goals are, that have really constrained growth and audience size to be more experimental. Like, the more pressure I feel to do A, the more I want to do negative A, which might just be like the petulant three-year-old in me. That's possible. That's part of it. But another is I just learn a lot more doing that and getting the practice in with stress testing various assumptions, right? Because I do think, and look, this could just be me justifying making all these decisions. This may not be germane to the conversation, so we can move on. But I do think the value capture by platforms is unbelievably high, and it's getting higher. It's getting disproportionately larger. And if you train yourself to chase the algorithms, like, you are basically being trained, right? You're being trained to follow whatever the sort of corporate directives are from an algorithmic perspective. And I think that can happen to a lot of people without them realizing it. And then you are not following your agenda anymore.
Yeah.
On some level.
What do you mean by the value capture?
What I mean by the value capture is, I'll give you one example. There are many ways to think about this, but I've heard some people talk about, say, owning your audience versus renting your audience. Right. So my priorities are reflective of a desire to have a certain degree of data independence and direct communication with my audience. Hence, email newsletter and a blog based on open source, in this case, WordPress. And that gives me a degree of ease in sleeping at night because I have an audience safety net.
Mm.
Because the audience, my listeners, my readers, that is my tribe. Those are the people who comprise, as Kevin Kelly might say, my 1,000 true fans. And if I can in any way have that stripped away, this is just one example, there are other examples, then you have a potentially really volatile situation on your hands. And I recall a long time ago, I was talking to this guy who owned one of the most profitable Facebook pages in existence. He was making millions of dollars a month on this Facebook page. And I asked him what it felt like. I was like, how does it feel to build a business on Facebook page? And he said, it is like having the most profitable McDonald's in the world on top of an active volcano. He's like, it's great, but it could just go away at any time. And it did go away because ultimately they throttled the organic reach and then they offered boosts and so on. Yeah. And his organic reach dropped 70%. And sorry, going out of business basically was where that took things. And for that reason, I would say that the more you are, for instance, pushed to build everything within a closed system, the reason that has that decision has been made on a corporate level from a UI and design perspective is for value capture. Otherwise, right, it doesn't translate to increased revenue or price per share, et cetera. And that's how the game is played in a lot of these, by necessity with these public companies. So I think about how I can step outside of that, even if that means I'm making decisions that from the outside looking in seem counterproductive. Now, I guess it's akin to, we're going all over the place, but this is kind of akin to like a buy and hold value investing type of approach versus like momentum investing. Mm-hmm. You can do really well if you're in a bull market and you invest in like tech growth stocks and you have some luck or ability or combination probably to time it properly. And if you know perhaps when to take your chips off the table from an investment perspective, you can do really, really well. And there are a lot of funds I could name that have done incredibly well with that kind of approach, but it only works in a bull market. The challenge with that metaphor is that with an audience, you can't just take your chips off the table, right? Like you are within the platform. So that doesn't mean I don't use these platforms, but I'm very cautious about having too many eggs in one basket. There are a lot of counterexamples. Right. There's so many examples I can point to, say on YouTube specifically, where, my God, I mean, people have just created behemoths and they have teams who help run the ship and develop ancillary revenue streams. And it's great. But I am fundamentally not an audio first person from a production perspective. I don't think I'm that good at it.
Video first.
Right.
Yeah.
Like you look at, say, just as a contrast, if you look at someone like Rogan, he is built for visual entertainment. He is very funny. Like he is an on-camera personality who's also very smart, ideal for video. And he was really the first podcaster I can think of who used YouTube really intelligently. And that was part of the reason he broke ahead. There's this, say, peloton of podcasts, Adam Carolla, Mark Maron, handful of others that were all kind of within one standard deviation of one another. And then Rogan just pulled away and was suddenly just in a different race completely. And I think that was predominantly due to his use of YouTube. But I don't think I will be particularly good at video and I won't particularly enjoy it. So I will not have the endurance or the consistency to compete well in that world. Mm. If that makes sense.
It does.
I just want to find a different game.
As in completely out of podcasting or really just focusing, using podcasting audio as an avenue to get people onto your email list and platforms that you own?
I would say both. The 10th anniversary of the podcast is coming up next month. And that'll be April, end of April, 2024. And I will use that as an opportunity to take a step back and take some time to think about what type of creative expression I think will be most fun, what types of experiments will be most fun and energy giving instead of energy draining. And I don't feel like there's any need to rush. I don't make good decisions when I rush. So I'm going to take plenty of time and I'm looking ideally, I don't know how easy this is going to be to find, but for something that is less crowded, not cutting edge, maybe dull edge, much like podcasting. When I started podcasting in 2014, it wasn't like it was brand new. It had been around for a while. And there were people who had been doing it for years at that point consistently, but it wasn't yet even remotely mainstream. And I like finding playing fields that are like that.
But no thoughts on what that next playing field is yet.
I don't know yet.
Or you're not going to share.
No, I honestly don't know yet. So I think that AR, VR, has a little ways to go.
Yeah.
Right. So I've looked at things like that, but I think that it might be just sitting there right in front of us. And in retrospect, it's going to be super obvious.
You guys know that I love investing because you know that if your money is just sitting in a bank account, you're losing out to inflation every single year. That's why you invest it so that it grows for you without you having to put in any extra work. I've been using an investing app called Webull for almost 4 years, and I had them do something really special for my listeners. By using my link to sign up today, you can get between 6 to 12 fractional shares for free. All you need to do is open an account and deposit any amount, even a dollar, to claim your free shares. So just by depositing a dollar, you'll get between 6 to 12 free fractional shares. And if you're wondering what to actually invest in, we talk all about investing in episode 28, so go ahead and listen to that episode. To claim your free shares through my special link, just go to ericataughtme.com/invest or click the link in the show notes. And it's Erica with a K. Again, that's ericataughtme.com/invest.
When you were saying you want to focus on creating a defensive moat around your identity, uh-huh. What do you mean by that? And what is your identity?
Yeah, a defensive moat around my impulse or instinct to compete. So what I mean by that, I think about identity a lot. So there are actually a few different ways I think about identity. One is diversifying my identity, right? If I am a podcaster and that is how I view myself, that is where my win-loss record exists. If it's a good week or month in podcasting, it's a good week for me personally. And just as important, if it's a bad week or a bad month, if Apple decides to kneecap downloads again, then suddenly my self-worth goes into the toilet. That's a problem. It's a very concentrated identity position. Whereas if I have, I'm making this up, but I mean, these are kind of real things for me, like skiing and then rock climbing and then podcasting and then a short film project. These are all real. Then I can do well if they're, which they should be, reasonably uncorrelated, like podcasting and rock climbing, as far as I can tell, not correlated. So I could, if I solve a new bouldering problem that week, I feel good about myself and it offsets, say, something out of my control in podcasting. That gives me a degree of resilience that is very helpful. I'm not saying that's the right thing for everybody, but for me, it's very helpful. In terms of protecting myself creating a moat around my impulse to compete, what I mean by that is there are times when I look at video and I'm like, I could do that. Like, I could figure this out and I could be really good if I took it seriously. And it pisses me off that I'm leaving so many chips on the table. I want to develop systems or checks that prevent me from indulging that.
Mm.
Because it's not what I should do. I'm not intrinsically motivated by it. I do not think I am, say, top 5% for producing video. And I could outsmart myself by trying to quote unquote win and waste a lot of energy and a lot of resources and a lot of my team's time by getting sucked into a fight like that of some type, right? It's just like feeding trolls on the internet. It's like, you do not want to get into a fight with someone who has infinite time on the internet, right?
Yeah.
So I want to be very cognizant of what type of bait I'm most likely to bite and to be really cautious about how often I allow that to happen so that you can be proactive instead of reactive, right? Like, how much are you playing offense versus defense? And by defense, I mean, you're just reacting to things that other people are deciding, right? And that's part of life. It's like, we're all interconnected. I'm not like rogue solo agent who's not affected by anything else in the world. But to the extent possible, I want to be able to step back, which is why I have this plan to basically take sort of a mental sabbatical for a bit to think about what I might want to do, which honestly could be something that has nothing to do with audience or anything. It could be writing fiction, could be developing a board game, could be working in graphic novels, could be something. Probably will be something more like that. And I trust that if we're bouncing around a little bit, but I trust that, let's just say, take the graphic novel as an example. So I collected comics as a kid. I still have all of my comics. I still have all of my D&D, like super fantasy nerd. I've always wanted to have a graphic novel. I think I'm actually very well suited to it. I mean, I can remember the floor plan of almost any restaurant I've ever been in my life, where I could sketch them out for you. I have a very good visual memory, so I can also storyboard pretty well. And as a comic book writer, like full script writer, I think that that is something, say, unlike video, where I could be very uniquely suited to be good. What does that mean? I don't know. But if I have the excitement, which recharges my batteries for everything else, and I think I could be good at it, and I'm going to develop relationships and skills that could apply elsewhere, say working with concept artists, which I've already been doing, then I trust that good things will come of that.
So myself, I feel like if I look at my entrepreneurial journey, maybe the first 2-3 years, I was running. Like it was, everything was a dash to the next goalpost. And now I'm still going pretty fast, but it's like a jog. And when I hear you describe...
I'm just laying in the ditch, smoking a joint.
I think you're like casually strolling. So was there a point in your career where you were walking? And then at what point did you feel like I'm comfortable enough, or I have enough in my bank account, or I'm confident enough in myself that I can walk? Or are you? Do you feel like you're walking?
Yeah, I feel like I'm walking. I feel like I'm walking right now, in part because I've done a lot of running. I'm very good at just going sixth gear, red line. I can do that really well. Whether that's a good or bad thing depends on the context, but I know I have that gear. What I think has helped me to slow down, there are a bunch of things. One, yes, financial freedom certainly helps, but I've had that for a while too. And I sprinted a lot and felt like I had to compete, or I wanted to compete. It wasn't that I felt I had to. There's a little bit of that, but like I love competing and I let that make decisions for me because I could win in a lot of things and that was very gratifying. But what I have noticed, I would say, if I look at the many people I've interviewed, 700 people, whatever it is, and I look at the people I've met as a result of that, which is a multiple, and then the friendships I've developed, and then my friends I had prior to the podcast, I'm looking at many, let's just call them thousands of very quote-unquote successful people. And one of the patterns I would say I've seen is that the more people feel like they are racing and rushing, the less content they are, the less at peace they are. And it's hard for me to think of a counterexample, honestly. So doing more of that does not produce better outcomes from a mental health or well-being perspective, as far as I can tell. There are some freaks of nature who just have different batteries. I'm putting those people aside because there are people who they can't sleep more than 4 hours a night because they're super sleepers and you know they can do like 70 pull-ups and then they have started 7 companies and they've all had exits and you know they have 4 kids and they play the piano in their spare time. Those people exist. Yeah. I'm just putting those people aside.
Yeah.
Because it's kind of like, well, like how did Michael Phelps learn to be such a good swimmer? And like, yeah, well, he learned to be a good swimmer, but also like look at his ankles and like look how this guy's built. You can't emulate that. So when I'm looking at things you can emulate, one is very rarely do long-term good things come from rushing or feeling rushed, as far as I can tell. And conversely, when you take a little bit of time and you're willing to kind of waste some days and weeks, you can, over the span of years, make a lot more progress.
Mm.
If you're never willing to slow down, you end up doing a lot of trivial things really quickly and really well. But there's a risk in getting good at the trivial stuff because then you're going to double down and do more of the same, let's call it trivial or less important stuff. And I remember my professor, the same professor who invited me back to talk to students because I had bootstrapped and everyone else he came in, and everyone else he invited to come in as a guest lecturer had venture-backed companies to get into the class because I had been abroad. So I was studying abroad in China at one point, came back and I missed the application cutoff. but I really wanted to take this class. It was a new class, high-tech entrepreneurship in the electrical engineering department. I do not have any engineering background. And students were raving about this class with a professor named Ed Shao, amazing guy. And so I sent my application, even though it was past the cutoff. And I was like, I'll do anything. Like, I'll clean the erasers after class. I'll do this. I'll do anything. Just like, I'll sit on the floor. It doesn't matter. You know, it's like begging via application. And he invited me to meet with him. And eventually he was like, okay, sure. And true to my word, I stayed afterwards and offered to clean the erasers and did that. And I think he let me do it once or twice. And then afterwards he was like, Tim, he's like, don't get too good at cleaning the erasers. And I was like, huh. Yeah, good point. He's like, yeah, you don't want to be good at that. So I do think about that. And it's very uncomfortable for me still at times to walk slowly. It's not my sort of default natural state. But it's kind of like being in a car on the freeway going like 80 miles an hour versus walking slowly. You're going to notice different things. Mm. And your perspective is going to be different. Not that one is automatically better than the other, but if you only have one perspective, I think that's a professional and personal blind spot.
I'm curious for myself, though. I feel like the reason you are walking is because you ran for so long and you built up your career and you made a strategic decision that when you started walking, it was the right time to walk. Because some people, I feel like if you start walking too early, you haven't reached your fullest potential. You haven't made it far enough to be able to start walking. So how do I know? Like I've gone from the sprint to I'm definitely jogging. I feel like if I started walking now, that would be premature. That would be really not taking advantage of this amazing opportunity that I have. How do I know when I can start walking?
I mean, I don't know if I can give a satisfying answer here. I will say that what you're pointing out is really important, and that is, and I'm gonna broaden a little bit, but how do you distinguish between what got somebody here versus what they do after they're successful, right? Yeah. Because for instance, I know a lot of like neurotic rich people who meditate now, and the lesson you could draw from that is like, oh, they became rich because they meditate. And it's like, no. They're neurotic AF. And once they had the space and they couldn't justify making more money because they already have all the toys, then they started meditating. So let's not confuse the arrows of causality. But I would say that two things. So I can talk about walking at different points in my life before anyone would have said I should have walked. I do have some examples of that. But let me ask you this. So why do you feel like you need to take advantage of this window of opportunity, whatever that represents? Like, what is the payoff of taking advantage of the window?
I think the payoff is achieving more, impacting more, and I think those are the two.
Okay. If someone gave you $100 million right now, I'm not offering because I can't do it, but if someone gave you $100 million, what would that change?
I'd still want to do exactly what I'm doing, but I wouldn't do it. I wouldn't put the pressure on myself. So if I didn't feel like releasing a podcast episode this week or filming a TikTok this month or this year, I wouldn't do it. But I'd still be doing my mission of helping people become better with their money. Okay. I just wouldn't do it at the frequency that I'm doing it now.
All right. So that's at 100 million.
Yeah.
Right. If I give you $1, you probably wouldn't change very much. So at what point in between those two would you take the pressure off yourself? What would allow you to give yourself permission to do that? Besides complete burnout when you get forced, which happens to a lot of people.
Well, the goal post I have is 100 million. Ooh. So I think once I get there, I will feel like I can still.
$100 million.
Yes. Wow. Versus, yeah.
How many Bugattis do you need?
You know, the weird thing, I don't need money for that. Yeah. I drive a rented Nissan Sunny. I really don't care about money for that. I care about money for the security it would bring me, my family, everyone that I care about.
Yeah.
And it's also just, it feels like a monopoly game. And I am competitive with myself. And I like the idea of having a benchmark and being able to prove this. I didn't know any millionaires growing up. I didn't know anyone who was making six figures growing up. Yeah. And to like be able to have this little fun game as a measure of how successful I am in my own game is interesting for me.
It is. It is interesting. This is where... So you and I may have some shared DNA with the competition side. What will happen, because I've seen people go from six figures a year to being billionaires. I've seen a bunch of them. And dozens of people make 100 million plus. I've seen this. And at first they'll say, once I have 10 million, and then they get 10 million. Once I have 20 million, and then it moves and it moves. They get to like 100 million. And then at some point they're like, all right, I can't even with a straight face say that I need more money. But what I can do is now talk about my like IRR, my annual like compounded growth rate. And now it turns into a percentage game, right? So instead of absolute numbers, they're like, all right, nobody is going to take me seriously to really say, I'm just going to be an asshole if I say I need more than $100 million. So like, did you beat the market? But how much did you beat the market? Like, oh, who are you using for your management? This, that, and that. And it'll turn into a percentage game. So I would say that if I look back just to step back to an earlier piece that I mentioned. The podcast started because I burned out on my third book, basically. And I wanted to take a long break from writing. And that book came out November 2012. And then the podcast didn't start until 2014. So that's basically about a year and a half of walking. At that point in my life, I feel pretty confident saying you probably have better finances now than I had then. And it was very uncomfortable, but I did walk for that period instead of doing what I knew how to do. And the excitement that came in to fill that void was ultimately the podcast, which then turned into, right? It's like when people come up to me on the street, now they... Very few people talk to me about the books. It's always the podcast, or at least it was for a long time. Now podcasts have become really saturated, so it's changed a bit. But similarly, when my first book came out, because also 2012, I hadn't had any major exits from my angel investing at that point. So I would say related to the angel investing around 2008, let's call it, started angel investing. Why? To diversify my identity also outside of publishing. I was also getting amazing introductions and opportunities because the early adopters were mostly in Bay Area, Silicon Valley tech. Then I would say, and this is something that might be helpful for folks, maybe not, but so Jeff Bezos has this concept of one-way and two-way doors, which is really just a metaphor for different types of decisions. So a one-way door is you walk through that is effectively an irreversible decision or very, very important and expensive decision to change later. Two-way doors, you go through, you can step back through. And that relates to my story because after the success of the 4-hour work week, every possible pressure internally, externally, from every stakeholder you can imagine was to do like the 4-hour work week, kind of like the chicken soup approach, right? And the 4-hour work week for whatever, dyslexic convicts and so on and so forth. And that could have worked, but then I would have been the 4-hour work week guy forever. I still might be, but I really would have painted myself into that corner. However, with the success of the first book, I had bought optionality where I knew someone would bet on me even if I colored outside of those lines. So I wanted to test the assumption that I needed to stay in the same category, which is why I did the 4-hour body. Total different section of the bookstore, completely different, although not philosophically, from the 4-hour work week. Physical performance instead of business and entrepreneurship. And once I was able to prove to myself, which I did, I knew I could go back to the 4-hour work week, right? That wasn't going anywhere. Mm-hmm. So it gave me confidence then at that point to take a little bit of time and work on this book that was entirely outside of sort of the permissible like board game area at that point. And then once I was able to do that successfully, I've proven to myself that my audience would follow me for my thinking, not just for a single type of subject matter. So that opened up the purview of what I could do tremendously, right? That type of, I don't want to call it diversification because it's not really first and foremost that, it's assumption testing. Like, why do people like my stuff? Like, really answering that question can be very freeing if you dig into it enough. And so for me, what that did is it provided me with the belief that I did not have to rush to deal with a closing door that was this limited strike while the iron is hot period of the 4-hour work week. I was like, oh, no. I can actually switch topics completely, and this is fine. I can try to, say, do more of a Gladwellian or Michael Lewis type of approach or John McPhee is one of my favorites, where people follow these writers for the subject matter, no matter what they choose. But in terms of like when to walk, when not to walk, super personal. I don't think it's not terribly easy to generalize. I think it gets forced on a lot of people. Right. So people run. They think everything's fine, or maybe they don't, or they maybe blind themselves to the fact that their relationships are starting to suffer. And then boom, they're like, marriage blows up. And then they get forced to walk for a while. That happens all the time. Could be run. And then their body's like, and their health craters.
That was me last year. I was sick for 3 months, and that was a forced walk, but I was very unhappy during that. I wanted to run.
Yeah, then you get to walk. So I would say it's not a really, for most people, putting the mutants aside, because there are mutants who can just go, and they will never get tired. There are those people. But putting those people aside, you're going to walk. So the question is, do you schedule it, or do you get it forced on you? That's kind of my take. So I, every year, also block out time for like no devices in nature, 1 to 4 weeks. I do that multiple times a year. And I've done that since the beginning. That is, I think, maybe the greatest juxtaposition to part of what we were talking about earlier, which is being careful not to conflate the things people do after they're successful with the things that cause their success. But the say mini retirements and those forced walks, where I'm often doing something that I think most people would consider pretty intense, but for me it's a different sport, it's the different gear, so it feels restorative. I have been building in those mini retirements since 2004. Those have been a constant, so I would directly attribute a lot of my breakthroughs to that, for sure. 100%, no doubt.
If you're listening, let me guess. You have a passcode on your phone. And let me take another wild guess and say that you have a password on your computer. But why are so many of us okay just being completely unprotected online? We have no idea who has all our personal information online and whether it's the good guys or the bad guys who might be selling your information or worse. We're talking spammers, telemarketers, robocallers, people who want to know more about you and even where you live. My sister had her data leaked online, and because of that, her identity was stolen. And it was a nightmare to deal with. We had to lock down all her credit cards just for starters. That's why I'm excited to tell you about Aura, a sponsor of this episode. Aura can identify data brokers exposing your info and submit opt-out requests on your behalf. When I discovered it, I knew I had to try it out, just to see if my information had been leaked online, which they let me see instantly after I signed up. And get this, for my audience, they're offering a free 14-day trial so you can see if your personal information has been leaked online. To find out now, go to ericataughtme.com/aura to claim your free 14-day trial. Erica with a K, and Aura is spelled A-U-R-A. Again, that's ericataughtme.com/aura, and I'll also leave the link in the show notes. I recently went on an anniversary getaway with the husband, and it was beautiful. Here's everything I got for free. We got free business class tickets for an international flight, which meant, yep, you guessed it, I got free access to the lounge where we could kick things off with a glass of champagne. Then we got a free stay at a 5-star hotel where we could relax and go to the beach. Okay, so now I'm sure you're wondering how I got it for free, and you know I don't gatekeep, so here's the insider knowledge you need to know. I did it by signing up for a free Bilt credit card. Bilt is a credit card that lets you earn points just for paying your rent, and there's no extra fee. And when I say free, I mean free. There's no annual fee for the credit card, and they don't charge a transaction fee for paying your rent with the card. You'll also earn 2 times the points on travel and 3 times the points on dining. Once you get your points, you can transfer them to travel partners like airlines and hotels to then get the free business class flights or 5-star hotels like I did. To sign up for this card, go to ericataughtme.com/built. Erica is with a K and built is B-I-L-T. Or to make it easier, go to the link in the show notes. Again, that's ericataughtme.com/built.
So if you were in my shoes, how would I implement a mini retirement? Just go off the grid for 3 months traveling?
I mean, 3 months would be ambitious for if you haven't done it before. I would say 4 weeks, and you're going to leave your phone at home, and you have to plan around it. And what that will do, it's not just about the recovery, but recovery is important, right? Like if you were an athlete, they wouldn't be like, okay, we're going to max load you at your highest mileage per day, every day, in preparation for a marathon. That'd be insane. Like no one would program it that way. Yet that's what a lot of people do in their business. And then they wonder why, like when the wheels come off, they're like, what happened? Like, I mean, you're just like walking into the bathroom doing 1 rep maxes all day, every day. Like, of course you're going to get hurt. So, so I would say there is the recovery piece of it, but the equally interesting piece is that if you, especially with what you do, were to schedule, let's just call it 4 weeks, and the duration matters because like 2 weeks you can leave and just let everything catch on fire and then come back and try to put out all the fires. 4 weeks, it becomes a lot harder. You actually have to, and here's the key piece, create systems and put in processes and rules and empower other people and bank, say, a bunch of content potentially, so that you can legitimately be inaccessible. If I were you, I mean, knowing the little that I do, just based on what you're telling me, I would say probably not a great idea to be close to broadband all the time, right? It's like if you're going into rehab, you wouldn't be like, okay, we're going to leave this cocaine on your desk. Just don't touch it. So it would be better if it's like, okay, we're going to go to Patagonia and like rent a car and go to these following inns. And like, I'm going to work on this longhand book project maybe, or work on some journaling and this, and this, or we're going to focus on our relationship and do a life book and da-da-da-da-da, but to really get off of devices and have a handful of weeks where you are pretty far away from convenient broadband. So if you're like getting a hit of the dope, it's obvious that you're kind of breaking the rules. And that's how I would approach it. And what is hard to overstate is how incredibly liberating it is once you do it once. Once you do it once, you're like, oh, wow. And you come back and you're like, things didn't fall apart, because they wouldn't, because you're organized. Or you're like, not only did things not fall apart, there are a bunch of systems I put in place that are actually going to persist and make things better.
Yeah.
And then you're like, oh, okay, well, we should do this every year.
Is there anything that you feel like right now you're running towards?
I would say family, probably, having family. I have some prereqs to hit, but you know, got out of a really long relationship about 1.5 years ago. It's very, you know, it's amicable. We're still on really good terms, but there were just a couple of things that weren't really going to work. We tried. We went to all the workshops, did all the therapy, all the things. But I would say, yeah, partner and kids.
Mm-hmm.
Running towards it, I mean, that is one of those things also. It's kind of like happiness, where it's like the more you grasp for it, the more you like scare away the butterfly. But if you like chill out, and I'm borrowing from, I think, Emerson or Thoreau, but like it might just like land on your shoulder and you're like, oh. It's like most people who chase, and I'm guilty of this too, who like chase happiness are the least happy.
Yeah. Right?
It's like the people are like just doing their thing, going for runs or having dinners with friends. And if you're like, hey, are you happy? They'd be like, yeah, I'm happy. But it's like the people who read all the books on happiness and like obsessed about happiness often find it, I think, counterproductive, right? Relationships are kind of like that. Like if you like are too graspy, I don't find it to be super productive. Certainly not very fun. So, but I would say family for sure, because the business stuff, sure. Business stuff is interesting. podcast, book, all the things. Great. It's fun. I enjoy it. Made a lot of wonderful friends, but you know, you can only play so many games of Monopoly or any game. And you're like, okay, I get it. I'm like, yes, I do love this game, but there are other games out there. So I think the family human experience is probably what I'd be. If I'm running towards anything, that is the clearest top priority for me. Mm. Like collecting more Skittles in the form of money or downloads or whatever does not really add anything.
What do you think it takes in a partner to complement you? Are you looking for someone who is exactly like you? Are you looking for a yin into your yang?
Man, I could read you my description. I've refined over a year and a half. I don't know. definitely complimentary. I mean, there's certain commonalities, I would say. So if anyone's listening, I would say probably, because I'd like at least two kids, I would say, probably between the ages of like 28 and 33. Well-educated is great. It's a proxy for a bunch of other things. So like somebody who's proven they can thrive in a challenging environment and organize their time and structure things is helpful as a proxy for a bunch of other things. Somebody who loves skiing prioritizes like snow sports. Because
wait, why the age, by the way? That's quite a bit younger.
It's quite a bit younger. I mean, it's not in like historic norm standards. It's not that crazy.
Is my audience, someone in my audience is going to hear this though. This is 70% women.
Yeah, I can tell you. It's very, so I have seen so many friends have so many challenges with kids and fertility that if I'm going to meet someone and we're going to have an unrushed, but you know, what's the right way to put it? Like sincere and meaningful, non-wishy-washy, but also non-rushed like courtship process. We're not going to get married in 3 months. I don't think it'd be a good idea. So let's just say that takes a year. And then maybe kids are a year after that, which would still be pretty fast. At 28, that puts somebody at 30. At 33, that puts them at 35. I've seen a lot of women have a lot of issues with fertility past 35. And that's just the biological reality. And these are people with incredible resources. They have access to the best doctors. They have access to the best labs. And freezing eggs helps, but it is not a panacea. Because unless you're going to use a surrogate and are going to take other sort of unorthodox, let's just call it, approaches, you also need to be healthy enough to carry that, say, viable embryo to term. And it is just a lot harder. Like after 35, it in the medical profession is considered a geriatric pregnancy, right? Mm-hmm. So, and there are exceptions, of course, right? Just like we were talking about the sort of mutants earlier, like there are women who are like, I had two healthy kids when I was 45. It's like, yes, okay, fine. But that is the exception, not the rule. So the 28 to 33 is thinking about two kids and a unrushed courtship process, basically.
Right? No, that's very fair.
Right. And that's just,
that's very fair.
I think it's easy for people who are ambitious, men and women, to kind of kick the can down the road because it's uncomfortable to think about these things. But when, I'm 46, so I've seen a lot of friends get married. I've seen friends get divorced. I've seen friends have kids and have a lot of trouble with kids. And I just have seen in my very limited direct circle of friends a high percentage of challenges with fertility.
Yeah. So, including me. When you were talking about the break earlier, the 4-week break I should take, I actually have a 4-week break planned, but it's to do IVF. So I don't know if that's going to count as like your mini retirement for me.
I think it will be you. You're going to be.
I just figure I'll be emotional and volatile. So I'm trying to prepare for the worst.
I think it's not. So may I give a couple of thoughts on that? So I have some experience with this, but I would say, so the first is you may not be volatile.
Okay.
So I have seen women who are totally fine and who expect to be volatile and who are not at all. So that is a possibility. I just want to put that out there. However, what I might suggest in the interest of domestic peace and long-term partnership is that if you're not going to inject yourself, maybe take like the first 2 weeks and like shack up with a girlfriend who's willing to help you with the injections to spare your significant other from the possibility of like the Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde situation.
What is that?
Well, if you really, really have a strong, like, volatile emotional response to the hormones, that you are able to, like, handle that with a girlfriend as opposed to just, like, you know, take out the baseball bat in the kitchen and have that affect your domestic dynamic.
I've never gotten that advice before, so that's helpful.
I'm actually
sure my husband might be happy.
I've seen, well, here's the thing. And then if you're like, coast is clear, no imminent threat, then fantastic, right? But rather than like hoping for the best and then experiencing the worst, like you can kind of like plan for the worst and then be pleasantly surprised.
That's so. I wasn't even thinking about him. I was more so thinking about protecting my team from the worst version.
Well,
of
there's
myself.
That too. There's that too. But it's not just about him. It's about your relationship, right? Because I've seen some pretty wild, like hurtful things. I've seen things said and done that people regret later. So like if you provide a little bit of buffer, I think that can be helpful. Okay, so 28 to 33, let's just say. 28, 29, 30 may be too young because I don't think women, I think a lot of women at that age want to date somebody who's mid-30s, late-30s, who can like be their adventure buddy for 4 or 5 years before they think about settling down. I'm happy to be an adventure buddy and travel around, but it's not going to be 4 or 5 years. So I think once women get to 30, then they're like, okay, reality check. And they take stock. So maybe practically what we're thinking is like 30 or 33. Woman who like has her life together and has done something that she is proud of, right? So let's just say outside of the education, and I can explain why that's if we want to dig into it, but I don't want to turn this into the Tim Dating Show. But this is, I mean, it is a lens into how I think about things.
It is very interesting.
So I would say somebody who has a strong identity of their own, who is proud of how well they have done something. And this is really important, I think. It could be kindergarten teacher, could be lawyer, could be astrophysicist, something. Because I have seen a lot of women when they have kids, if they have not checked that box, develop. This is also, I think, a fairly American thing. It's not true in a lot of other cultures, but develop resentment towards their kid or their husband slash partner for having given up their career development. And I've not seen that go well. Not once. Secondly, I think each person in a relationship needs to have an identity on solid footing so that one doesn't get subsumed by the other, right? Like I have a strong personality. I think my EQ is pretty high, but it's like I'm very focused and I can be very driven. And if someone doesn't have their own stuff going on, they can just get pulled into that gravitational pull and that can become problematic.
And then that's not really attractive to you. Like I would not be attracted to someone who got pulled under my gravitational pull and then didn't have their own identity.
Yeah, I think it's if it happens subconsciously, if it's not a decision, then I think it's a problem. Right. At the same time, I don't think we're really getting into the weeds here. I don't think you can have like two super alpha people in a relationship. I don't think that works. And it's not a gendered thing, but it's like if you have two, that I just have not seen that work out super well. So,
I haven't either, actually.
Yeah. So
I know super alphas who were together, but then it blows up.
And this can change at different points in a relationship, but I'm very driven. I have a lot going on. So it would feel very nurturing and like a refuge to me to have a home in which my partner is very, very, like my biggest supporter also, right? So... And that could change, which it has in relationships in the past, where then somebody goes to like grad school. I'm like, okay, now I am your biggest supporter, right? I could keep going. But honestly, I think if it's age range, well-educated, comfortable in like ski pants and dense prose, and prioritizes a lot of activity outside and is really good at self-care and like has a real job, preferably, because there's a lot of faux jobs floating around out there. And the reason that's important is not because I need somebody to make a ton of money. I want to know that life isn't always hard for them. right? Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of women also would want that in a partner, or not to make this too cisgendered, whatever, but you want to know, for instance, that like if you have kids together, God forbid something happens to you, will your partner be able to handle really stressful situations, right? Because like all of our parents are going to die. Hate to say it, but it's like when you're first dating and like everyone's parents are healthy, you don't have any kids. If life is really, really hard for someone at that point, it's probably not going to get better, right? If they go into hypersympathetic fight or flight when things get hard. So the things I mentioned in part are just substitutes, like proxies for trying to assess if someone's been able to handle hard things in the past. Because life isn't always easy. It gets hard a lot. So thank you for coming to my TED Talk. I appreciate it.
Do you have a link to apply?
Yeah. Go to tim.blog/partner to provide your details.
That was honestly very fascinating, the way you've thought through this, because I feel like most people do not think through dating and their partners like that. They kind of find a person and they think, okay, this checks five of my boxes, but their boxes are also like tall or handsome.
Yeah, there's a lot of, you know, it's easy to get, the surface level stuff also does matter.
Yeah.
Right? It's like if I think it's really important that you are very attracted to your partner when you first meet, if there's to be any chance of having that attraction 5 years later. Very important. But then there's all the other stuff that may not be as obvious, right? So for instance, I'll give one that's a little touchy for a lot of people, but so here I am, pretty, let's just far along in my career. And if I'm with someone, there's going to have to be a conversation around like finances and probably some like prenup or document or something like that. It's very uncomfortable for everybody. Part of why I would want someone, say, with a real job or who is financially literate, who has savings, is so that money isn't abstract to them. If it's abstract, and I've seen this happen over and over again, if it's too abstract and someone doesn't have the requisite level of financial literacy, they will get, I'll just say, in the situation I've seen with a lot of my friends, like male friend, wife-to-be, who maybe doesn't have a lot of financial exposure, she will get hijacked by a lawyer because they have to have separate legal counsel. And the types of proposals that will come back will seem insane to the guy. Mm-hmm. That is less likely to happen if someone has built their own savings and has that type of familiarity. And the last thing I would want is to be with someone and then have that blow it up a year and a half in when everything else is going well. That would just be so incredibly sad. So I'm trying to head that off in advance by having someone who's created their own wealth, even on a small scale, right? So it's a lot to ask for, but it's a big world out there.
That's fair. And they can listen to Erica Taught Me to become more financially literate and then go to...
That's right. Bam. Tim.blog/partner. 20% off.
One of my...
Join my female-only mastermind.
One of the things I'm curious about is the way that you think about the world and the way you think about your life now and your priorities and the way you're walking. I really don't think that is how most people in their early 20s should be thinking about it. Mm-hmm. Do we disagree there?
I don't think we disagree. But I would say maybe the reason for that conclusion could be different. So I don't think that running in itself is fundamentally high ROI. What I do think is when you're younger, you do not know what you're really good at, nor what you will be very good at. So you have to throw a lot against the wall to see what sticks and then double down on that, see if it works, see if you can replicate, see what you really enjoy, right? What energizes you? What is easier for you than it is for other people? That's a question I ask myself all the time. Like as I'm going into this sort of mental sabbatical with the podcast for a little bit, I'm asking my friends, like, what do you think is easier for me that is harder for other people? Because that acts as a different way to phrase a bunch of other questions. Mm-hmm. And to have viable answers to those things, you have to have tried a lot. And when you're young, you just don't know, because you haven't tried a lot. So you do need to throw a lot against the wall, and that manifests, I think, as a lot of hours oftentimes. But I would say you just need to be cautious. If you get good at driving in sixth gear, that at some point you figure out how to use the other gears. For most folks, I would say that. And it's also not about a binary choice between running and walking. It's not like, okay, I'm going to run for the next year and then I'm going to walk for the next year. I took kind of the last 2 weeks off, so to speak. I mean, I've been doing stuff and having team calls and so on, but it's been pretty chill. And then I'm going to have a sprint. I'm going to have a sprint in the next couple of weeks to write a short film and cast and film a short film, hopefully. We'll see if I make the deadline.
Wow.
And that will be run. That will be focused, caffeinated run for sure. And then I already have it scheduled. That's the key point related to the mini retirement. I don't wait to burn out or to start to fail or to falter before going to walk. I have it scheduled. I know when my run ends. And then I go into like jog.
Because you know you're getting close to the burning out, or
no, I'm preventing
you just randomly
I'm
pick preventing, a day.
I'm preventing the burnout by having different types of training loads, to use sort of an exercise analogy, right? So I'll sprint and burn the candle at both ends, and I'll have a lot of fun doing it because I enjoy that intensity for a short period of time. And I figured out for myself how long I can do that before I start to fray at the edges, which I think is probably longer than most. Like I can really focus for absurdly long periods of time. But there is a tax. Like the mind and the body are not separate. Like those types of activities have a biological cost. And then I will have a period of, say, travel and focusing on different types of subjects where, not to like strain this athletic metaphor too far, but it's like different terrain, or maybe it's like riding a bike instead of running. So the stressors are slightly different, but I'll be studying, say, I'll be studying a couple languages and traveling and taking my family on a trip, which I do once a year. And that'll be its own stress. It'll be great, but like it'll be its own thing.
Yeah.
And so I'm alternating the type of training load rather than just pushing to redline. I find that to work well for me, and it allows me to come back to the sprint really effectively when I want to do that. I still enjoy sprinting. But I really try to keep hard sprints to probably 2 weeks or less.
When you're doing those intense sprints and those intense mm-hmm. periods of activities, what are, you think, the most impactful?
Not all activities are created equal when you're going through one of these sprint periods, in my experience. So there are certain resources that if used, or certain capacities that if used, you reduce, let's just say, the fuel tank. So this would be true for, say, certain types of endurance training. You have muscle glycogen, liver glycogen, that gets depleted, and then you need to refill. There are other resources that the more they are used, the more you have, like creativity, right? There's not a finite source of creativity. So the more you exercise that muscle in different ways, the more you have. And I would say that with the activities that I might use, I'm probably going to have a combination of just pure physical exhaustion because my mind is going to be going a mile a minute. So there will be part of me to avoid onset insomnia that will use, say, heat towards the end of the day to just tire myself out, and also lots of walking and weight training. Okay, fine. Those are all pretty boring, but they're effective for exhausting the body. Then I have, I would say, the social component. So when I'm going through a period like that, the number of group dinners with friends that I schedule goes way up because writing can be so isolating. Since writing can be such a solitary experience, I will build social scaffolding in all sorts of activities, and that is to keep the cup from getting too drained, since that always ends in basically a poor work product for me in terms of the book. So group dinners, acro yoga, my like actual physical touch with other humans, and anything that could be social, rock climbing. I would say in the morning, and this is also related to sleep, a lot of it revolves around sleep. I will try to use cold exposure whenever possible, but it's not for the million benefits that a lot of people online are talking about. Even though I will point out there's a whole chapter on cold exposure in The 4-Hour Body, came out in 2010. Certainly people have used cold exposure for thousands of years prior, but as a mood elevator and basically a coffee substitute, it's good for me to use cold exposure so that I don't overconsume caffeine. If I overconsume caffeine, then I get into a vicious cycle of having to use downers, or maybe even if I'm having group dinners, slip into using alcohol to take the edge off, trying to go to sleep. That further compromises sleep. Then I wake up, then I have more caffeine, et cetera. So to avoid that cycle, a cold is a really useful adjunct. And I would say those are the primaries. And then just for sympathetic regulation so that you're not going into fight or flight, whether it's something you label as anxiety or otherwise, 20 minutes twice a day for some type of meditation, just to prove to yourself that you can do it. I don't think the type of meditation matters that much. It's just sitting quietly for 20 minutes and realizing that the whole world doesn't fall apart. That, I think, imbues you with a sense of calm that allows you to, this was in the Tools of Titans, no hurry, no pause. It's like, you don't have to hurry, but you don't have to pause. Just like calmly execute on your plan for the day, and you can take those 20 minutes and things are not only not going to suffer, they're going to be less stressful. And I really attribute a lot of that to why Tools of Titans was the most fun I have had in terms of writing a book, by far.
If I were to task you to change someone's life, but you can only give them three pieces of advice of everything that you've ever written about, what are those three pieces of advice?
So I'd say the first is, if it's not in your calendar, it's not real. Like all these things you have on to-do lists, all these things that you hope to do, if it's not in your calendar, it's not real. Like put it in your calendar. That would be number one. And these are not in ranked order, but the first would be put it all in your calendar. If you want to actually get something done, it needs to be in your calendar. If you're planning on doing something for your family, doing something personally, taking a mini retirement, don't expect that you're going to fit it in when you find free time. You're never going to find free time. Life will crowd it out, or the amazing business stuff will also crowd out everything I just mentioned. So block it out, put it in your calendar. If it's not in your calendar, it's not real. That's number one. Number two would be fear setting, the exercise of identifying all of the things that could go wrong if you do what you're considering doing. And then there's a whole exercise. People can find it, tim.blog/TED, because the TED Talk, which has, I don't know, 12 or 14 million views now, is all about this. And that exercise, which I still use, I would say probably once a quarter now, for big decisions. Like I did it for considering what I might do for the 10th anniversary. And that is a real unlock. Another piece of that that gets neglected a little bit, so I'm going to emphasize it. The fear setting is just like goal setting, right? So you're making it specific, measurable, et cetera, so that you can overcome the emergency brakes that you're putting on. And it's not just enough to have a compelling goal, although that's important. The other piece of the fear setting exercise that gets neglected a lot is really journaling on and calculating the cost of inaction, right? So we think about all the things that could go wrong if we do the thing. But what we do less is think about 1 year from now, 3 years from now, what does my life look like? What are the costs if I don't do the thing I'm considering? That's very, very, very important, the cost of inaction. Okay, so that's fear setting, be number two. And then I would say number three, if people haven't done it, do a loving kindness meditation. This is going to sound so woo-woo. We're sitting here in Austin, so I guess it's appropriate. But metta is also another word that's used, M-E-T-T-A. But a loving kindness meditation, let's just say twice a day as an experiment. It could be once a day. I was doing it when I was writing Tools of Titans, when I would do the sauna. When I would do the sauna, I would do a loving kindness meditation. And there's an excerpt from a book called Joy on Demand by Chade Meng Tan, I believe is how I'm supposed to pronounce his name, but I could be butchering it. He created a course at Google for Googlers called Search Inside Yourself that became mega popular. And one piece of that was this loving kindness meditation. And some of the people took this advice to do these loving kindness meditations, which is in effect wishing a certain number of people, friends of yours, family, joy, lack of pain, etc. The key thing to underscore here is you are not thinking about yourself. And a number of people who took the course came back to him and said, this is the happiest I think I've been in 10 years, just from doing this for 2 days. And I would encourage people to try that. It's really pretty eye-opening how getting off of the me, me, me song for even 5 minutes, 10 minutes can be really transformative to your day-to-day experience. So I would say those three, because one is about, let's just call it achievement. If it's not in your calendar, it's not real. Another is about overcoming fear, and anxiety would certainly be a form of that, right? Being trapped in the future in a way, anxiety. Often thought loops that repeat that haven't really been cross-examined. So fear setting is very, very helpful for that. And then the last is the, in effect, prizing what you have, not just what you want, right? Like the gratitude piece, the well-being component of things. And I think regularly applied, those three are really powerful. Those would be my three.
I love that. This is a bit awkward given what number three was, but I have a me, me, me question.
Let's do it.
Do you have any advice specifically for me?
What do you feel like you need help with? I mean, what are the main breaks that you have on or challenges that you want to remove, obstacles? Not to say that I will have an answer, but yeah. I might. I mean, what...
I think the one that I still challenge you and I don't fully buy is that I can take a break right now and not impact the growth and the trajectory. I hear so many people say this after they've made it. I don't think I believe it 100%, but I would like to believe it.
Well, why would you like to believe it?
Because I would like a little break. I'd like a little...
Well, there's not much to believe with respect to my personal story because I've done it since 2004, right? So it's just a statement of record. I'm not talking about, you know, the many gods problem or something. Like this is just my calendar for the last 10 plus years. So it can be done. Whether you personally can do it, you can do it. The question is, what would be the upside or downside or the combination of upsides and downsides of doing it? I would say that it's very easy to get seduced by socially reinforced vanity metrics, and we all are. So that might be downloads for me or views for someone else, or you're talking about the growth trajectory. So however you measure growth, right? But if you really are talking about impact, you used that word before, growth I'd be very cautious around. That is a very double-edged sword. So I feel like there should be good reasons behind growth, and there are good reasons for growth. But I would say impact can be a very squirrely word, and bigger doesn't necessarily mean more impact. Right? You could have, I mean, there are, let's just take as an example, there are YouTube channels out there, I'm not going to name them. They have a gazillion subscribers. But I would say that their impact, if we're saying making people chuckle for a few minutes, is high, but it's kind of an inch deep and 1,000 miles wide. That is one form of impact. But if you were to, and I'm not saying you should do this, but if you were to volunteer one afternoon or one night a week at a senior citizen's home and spend time with people who have no family to keep them company in the last sort of 12-month glide path until they die with terminal illness, like, I would say that's arguably more meaningful than the preceding example. So I would think very, not just think about impact, but I would journal on impact. It's very hard to track your own thoughts, at least for me. But if you trap your thoughts on paper, you can really cross-examine them afterwards, and you can see where things don't quite make sense or where they're not as compelling as they seem when you repeat them to yourselves a lot. And I'm using the plural here because we all do it. I do it too, which is why I journal so much in part. So I would say that historically, just having seen thousands of people attempt mini retirements, like tens of thousands, I mean, millions of people have bought this book, right? So a lot of people have tried mini retirements. I would say the most common feedback I get is all the things that I thought I was going to sacrifice, I didn't need to sacrifice. And I actually gained A, B, C, D, and E from it. I'm sure that's not true across the board. I'm sure there are people who try to approach it and for whatever reason, the house burns down. I don't think that would happen for you, but it seems like the upside payoff of taking a break is not compelling enough to outweigh the fear of losing the momentum that you have.
Mm.
So it's not just the risk of downside. It's that you may just not want the break as much as you would need to want the break. I will emphasize, though, it's not just about the break. And I know I mentioned this before, but it's about the systems and the processes that you create that then free you from feeding this monster that is a business you've created, right?
Yeah.
So if you want to, say, build something, I'm not saying this is what you're trying to do, but for instance, if you're trying to build something that you could sell, then you would want to practice this type of thing so that you are not key person risk who basically needs to work forever with a corporate overlord if they were to buy your company, as an example. So there you have it. But I would say a lot of people, including people who run companies with like hundreds and thousands of employees, have taken many retirements. So it can be done. It can be done. But not everybody wants or needs to do it. And if you feel like you have a tiger by the tail and you're like, this is my moment, mm-hmm. then like go nuts, you know, like try it. However, if next year, this time and the year after that, you still are saying the same thing, then I call.
Yeah. It's funny. The most compelling part of that argument for me was the fact that doing a mini retirement forces your business to be able to operate without you and not have a keeper's risk. I think logically, I relate to that.
Yeah, there we go.
That's a good one. Mm-hmm. The podcast is called Erica Taught Me, but really today is all about Tim Taught Me. So what do you want people to walk away saying, Tim taught me this?
If you really want to get a lot of serious work done, you just cannot take yourself too seriously. You cannot. You'll flame out. And the most impressive people I have met, by impressive, I mean not just high achieving, but people who can sit around at a dinner and laugh at themselves and seem to be enjoying the ride are people who get really serious work done while also deliberately not taking themselves or their petty little human problems too seriously. And of course, there are critical situations. There are crises. There are health scares. There are all these things, and you have to contend with them. But if you approach all of it in a really solemn, serious way, you will burn out. Full stop. So I would say no hurry, no pause. And if you want to really make a huge impact, you're not going to do it mimicking whatever your group is that surrounds you. It's just not going to happen. If you really want to have outsized impact, you're going to have to do something different. And that requires testing and pushing at the edges and trying A when everyone's doing B. And a lot of the time, your little experiments will prove to you that, in fact, the best practices that your friends are embracing might be the right playbook, but there will be exceptions. And then you will find those exceptions make all the difference. So I'd say that's what I would want people to take away. You don't need to sprint all the time.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, you're welcome.
If you've enjoyed the episode, please take a moment to leave a review. It really helps support what we're doing. Thanks for listening, and I'll talk to you next Tuesday on a brand new episode of Erica Taught Me.